session number 23370, reel 14.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the doctors that were with you?
Well, in the group that I was with, which was known as the Java 5A group, and consisted of about 3,000 people, we had two doctors, both Americans, Samuel Lumpkin and Dr. something Epstein. Lumpkin was a younger man. He was out of the artillery unit. Epstein was an older person, had been in the Navy for some number of years, and had been on his way home from his posting in the Philippines, where he'd been for a number of years, and was getting transport in the USS Houston. But unfortunately, he got tangled up with the rest of us, and so Dr. Epstein was lumbered with us, or that sort of thing. But
what sort of character was he?
He was. If you remember, years ago there used to be a cartoon in the paper called The Sad Sack. That was Dr. Epstein. During his period in Manila in the Philippines, he had acquired a great number of lightweight tropical suits and shirts and clothes of every degree, and had anticipated not having to buy any more. Of course, in the Philippines, they get them so cheaply. But he had anticipated that he had enough to last him for the rest of his life. But of course, unfortunately, they finished up on the bottom of Sunda Strait. So our Dr. Epstein had probably some reason to be a bit of a sad sack. But nevertheless, he was quite an efficient doctor, but was not terribly interested in doing too much for us. But Lumpkin had apparently been a gynecologist before he became involved with the US Army. Very softly spoken bloke, but quite a good doctor, and under the circumstances was quite innovative and quite a good doctor. When we moved up from the 100 kilo camp, and while we were there, cholera broke out. Cholera is a dehydrating disease, and it's the same in a vastly magnified degree as dysentery. It just wastes you away, but it does it so quickly, a matter of 6 or 7 hours, and you can go from being normal to being nothing and being dead. It's a pretty deadly sort of thing. And we had a couple of cases in the camp, and the moment that occurred, Lumpkin went to the Jap administration and said, this was all in the camp, of course, and said that we had cholera in the camp. And the Japs immediately said, well, you stay over there and you keep your cholera over there. It's not to come near us. This was the attitude they took. So Lumpkin said, well, don't be so bloody silly. There's nothing I can do about it. But you can do something about it. And he said, he gave him a list of medicines that he wanted. And I said, no, you can't have them, just like that. So he said, all right, The best thing you can do then is to get me lime. This is what do you call it? Agricultural lime, that sort of thing. You want bags and bags of it. And I said, no way. He said, right, welcome to the world of cholera, because he said, I'll catch it, you'll catch it, and he said, and you'll be dead just as much as me. Where's that effect? And he left them with this threat hanging over their heads. The next day, up comes a truckload of lime. So he did very well with it. Everywhere around the camp where people walked all the time, particularly around the kitchens and the toilet areas, which were merely big holes dug in the ground, there was lime everywhere. And it trampled, of course, from there through everywhere, etc., etc. And it was quite noticeable that during that period where we had cholera in the camp, that we were left strictly alone. The Japs, the guards used to wander in at night. When you're way out in the jungle and there's you can hear all these animals at night, these gibbon monkeys, and they used to be in this big hill behind the camp, and they would be out all night with this whoo, and the guards never used to be very keen about staying out on the perimeters of the camp, which is where they're supposed to be, and they'd all be in around the huts, and they'd come in there and on the pretext of inspecting what was going on in the huts, etc., but come in to be near the light and near the fires we had going in the huts. But when this cholera scare came around, bingo, they didn't come around at all. But due to Lumpkin and his efforts with the lime, etc., we escaped very lightly with the cholera. I know that it comes through in belts and in various areas, but we were very fortunate to get out of it, and a lot of that we could put down to the fact of Dr. Lumpkin pushing with these blokes. But as well as the doctors, we had sick bay attendants, etc., that we had brought with us from the ship, and they and the doctors actually worked miracles as far as treatment of people was concerned.
As I understand it, once you got cholera, in many cases, it was the end of you.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
How many people do you think that your doctors were able to save on a whole once they had cholera?
None that I'm aware of when we were under the cholera cloud. But there were others at a lot of the other camps. They apparently did save quite a lot of people with cholera. But of course, the treatment for cholera is saline, to get saline into the body to stop this dehydration that goes on. It's actually a ghastly thing to see it occur. One of the blokes off the Perth, Dickie Bevan, he died from it, and it was overnight. And he went to bed that night. This was when we were back onto reasonable hours, and He went to bed that night and he was gone by 6 o'clock next morning, or by daybreak next morning. He was gone. It was just as quick as that. And he'd been quite normal when he went to 10 o'clock at night. It's a murderous thing.
Your doctors, were they able to utilise the idea of intravenous drips and things like that, that people have spoken to me previously about, improvising saline solution, that sort of thing?
Not so much in our camp. Some of the other camps, with blokes like Dunlop, Bruce Hunt, Nairn, some of those doctors, they were very much into it. And there was a Dutch doctor. He introduced a form of twilight sleep that enabled them to perform operations and do that sort of thing. But that was with a knowledge of native poisons and drugs and that sort of thing. So there was some very remarkable efforts were achieved. They were quite marvellous.
Given the fact that you didn't have the medical supplies that you should, or certainly would need to have to combat sort of tropical diseases that you were experiencing, what good were the doctors to you in your particular instance?
Well, psychological as much as anything. Yes, they maintained a standard of cleanliness and hygiene, that sort of thing, and that was of enormous benefit as far as we were concerned. As I say, we got swiped by this cholera epidemic, but dysentery was one of the worst problems. That and the tropical ulcers, they were absolute terrors. But there again, there's quite a bit of treatment came about with from the black market. Strangely enough, no matter where you go in this world, you can pick up a black market somewhere. And one of our blokes who was a sick bay attendant, suddenly he had a line of being able to pick up stuff called iodoform. Now, iodoform was a forerunner of some of the sulfur drugs, or similar to some of the sulfur drugs. And this iodoform, if you could pay for it, and you could get sufficient, it was very effective against these ulcers. Iodoform was used mainly in veterinary cases where they had bad sores and that sort of thing on animals, but it was very effective as far as these things were concerned. But payment was always in gold. Gold was always a commodity that you could do good with, you know? Whether it was a ring or part of your tooth or whatever it was always made things always available to you. But
were you able to get things from locals? Not necessarily on the black market, but
food,
for instance.
There was no supplements for food, but you could get tobacco. The tobacco consisted of mainly cheroots, that sort of thing. We were getting paid 10 cents per man per day, provided you worked, you know, this sort of thing. And that 10 cents We used to put this into buying these cheroots and those sort of things. Pretty explosive damn things they were, terrible. But of course, if you smoked, well, then of course you had to have them. You know, that was about it. With a lot of the, one of the problems, of course, was where do you get paper to roll cigarettes in? That was the other part of the equation. But
on the whole, where did the paper come from?
Well, wherever you could get it. Newspaper wasn't much good because it was too porous. Notebooks, anything at all, anything was paper, was gradually getting torn down until there was hardly anything left. Books, ordinary novels, that sort of thing, weren't much good because, again, generally they were fairly porous. But if you had a book that was sort of a quality book, right, you could use the paper out of them. So improvisation the whole way, that was what it was. But
to what degree did paper become more important? Were you able to sell it? Were you able to benefit from having a book?
No, we didn't. You'd give it away, but you didn't. Never sold it. That was, because your money was worthless anyway. That was.
How was the payment doled out to you?
I've still got some in there somewhere. Some little bank notes. Japanese government promises to pay 10 cents. That sort of bloody. It was only toy money, and they used to bring it out by the shipload. Of course, they just flooded the place with money, and of course they absorbed all the local monies. They absorbed that and took that and left the invasion money, which was bloody hopeless stuff. But around about this time, when we first got the ability to send a note home. Standard forms, and all you had to do was cross out or put a tick against "I am well" and that sort of thing. That was about what they were. And you had, I think you were allowed to put in 10 words, I think, at the end of it and sign it. So they were hopeful signs that made a little bit of difference to your attitude. Prior to that, we didn't know anything apart from what you used to get from the supposed radio messages, that sort of thing, and the news that came through. But as far as us sending any messages home, that was round about when we first got any. Had any allowance at all at doing this sort of thing, which was mid-1943 or thereabouts. 1943. So that was almost 15, 16 months after we'd been sacked, before we could send any messages at home or to home. But that was an indication, or was a bit of a psychological uplift at the time to be able to do that.
You've been mentioning sharing out paper, the cigarettes. I wanted to discuss with you the sort of importance of having close mates around you.
Absolutely. In our particular case, where we were up on the line, prior to when we were first in Java, you teamed up with a mate and you stayed with him the whole time. I teamed up with this particular bloke, and when we got up into Burma and we started out on this business of working, there were eight of us formed a group, and we always used to work together. Now those eight blokes pretty well stuck together. There were four of us in particular. Every now and again we'd have a day off, and the first thing you did on your day off was to go and wash your clothes, which consisted of what, a pair of shorts and a shirt, that was about it. But we would go and play bridge. We had a pack of cards and we'd go and play bridge. And we'd play bridge from the moment that you'd finished your washing, which was in the first hour, until it was too dark to see the cards at night. That formed a pretty close relationship. And that existed also between those eight. Now, of that group of eight, I think there's only two of us left now. But this bloke that I teamed up with, he eventually got a bad ulcer on his leg. And we kept him at home and this sort of thing, and used to go and get his meals for him and that sort of thing, and make sure that he was all right for cigarettes and this sort of thing. And it was quite remarkable that when we went out, if he was forced out to work, that the group of eight would look after him and make sure that whatever we were doing, and at that particular time we were doing a bit of quarrying. We were getting ballast out for the line. Of course, when you get the, we'll do this ballast work, you had to do a lot of spalling with a sledgehammer, hitting the big rock and making them into little ones. But of course, all the bits that come off those rocks, of course, they come off a tremendous force, and they will particularly shatter into your shins, that sort of thing. So what we used to do was to make a shin guard out of a piece of bamboo and tie it onto your legs to prevent this sort of, try and stop some of it anyway. But this mateship used to work around this bloke in particular, but that was fairly indicative of what used to happen. It occurred over lots of other people within the whole of the Java party, that if your mate was sick or something was wrong, you looked after him, and conversely, when you were crook, he looked after you. So it was the way that it worked. If both of you were sick, then there was always somebody from in that group of eight that could come around and just make sure you were all right. It did work, and it worked very well, but it was absolutely necessary to have a mate in the not only in your group, but sort of alongside you all the time.
In relation to the sicknesses like cholera, what was it like then when one of those mates was lost? How did that affect the group?
Very badly, of course. But of course, you didn't have time to grieve very much. Your grief was always kept within yourself.
Were you given time to sort of honour their passing in any way?
No, you. All that happened was that they were taken over and buried over in the what was a little cemetery over the way, this sort of thing. And the only thing that occurred was that there was the generally one of the officers plus the burial party that had to go and dig the hole and fill it in, that sort of thing. And the bugler was always there and did the honours as far as the burial was concerned. But there was no time to grieve as much as you knew what was going on. By this time, of course, we were into the wet season, and the wet season wasn't very nice. That was pretty crook. But it didn't stop the speedo, it didn't stop the push, it was there with you the whole time.
Can you describe what it's like to be working out in the wet season?
Yes, it was just like virtually being under a shower all day. That's at that time, clothes were more of a nuisance than anything else. We just invariably just used to wear a G-string. I was subject to these attacks of malaria all the time, and to help me, I had a bag that was the same as a brown bag, a corn sack, call it what you like. And I used to, I had a piece of wire as a clip, and used to put it around over my shoulders and around my neck, and just have a clip there. So that I had it over my shoulders and that sort of thing. That was there all day. And used to hang it up near the fire at night to dry it off so that it would be dry again for the next day. But the rain is just so constant in a lot of those places that it's, as I say, just like working under a shower the whole day. But the ground, of course, turns to mud, and the more that it's trodden over, the worse it gets. But there was an occasion there. We were working on a bridge at the 100, and there were, I suppose, about a couple of companies or even a battalion, I suppose, of Japs marched down the road. And, of course, when I say marched down the road, it was... was sloppy mud, that's all it was, and they were having an awful lot of trouble. And at the back of the this group, I would suppose there would have been a couple of hundred of these blokes, they were going past, and at the back there were two blokes just absolutely staggering along, two of these Japs, and there was a sergeant major with them, and he was beating them with the flat of his sword to keep them going. And as they got opposite us, they went down, and he beat them more with this blasted great sword. It was still in his scabbard, of course, and he just beat them and gave them a bit of a right kicking, and then on he went after the rest of them. Now, we said to the guard, you know, these blokes, go and give them a drink, you know, pick them up. No way, they wouldn't go near them. So, you know, one of our blokes said, oh, well, I'll go over and do it. And he copped a clout around his ears for even suggesting it. But they just left them lie there in the mud. Now, that blokes could have been drowning in the mud or anything, you know, it was that bad. But within, oh, I suppose, about half an hour, along came a truck. Now, this truck was one of the English four-wheel drive trucks, and of course it was just ploughing along. And when they got to where these blokes were, they just pulled up alongside them. Two blokes got out of the truck and picked them up. dropped the side of the truck, and one on their head and one on their heels, and picked them up and just flung them up in the back of the truck. Put up the sides of the truck and just drove off. And that was fairly indicative of what chance we had when they wouldn't even look after their own people. Yeah.